Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line William Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests. He's the author of a number of books we carry. We carry his book on America's God and Country, and his book on, and of course, the CD on America's God and Country, and on St. Patrick, and on St. Nicholas, and on George Washington Carver. And of course, we are going to be carrying his new book as well. What's the name of that book, Bill?
Oh, Dr. Stan, it's called Backfired, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Religion.
Okay, fine. Well, we're going to be carrying that one, Backfired. You can remember that. And, of course, it goes into the background of religious tolerance in America. But I really wanted to spend at least part of this evening talking about what happened with Terri Schiavo. Now, a lot of people want to put that behind us, and, well, too bad about Terri. And yet, of course, you have to understand that this was a very well-manipulated propaganda bit. And, of course, Terri was simply the victim of this whole scheme. How often, as they were in the process of killing Terri, did you see on your television pictures of the husband bending over his wife, who looked very pretty? She obviously, she couldn't speak, but he looked over so attentively. But she looked so pretty there. And then you'd hear the lawyer coming on, who incidentally is pro-death. He's part of this whole pro-death movement, and in my estimation, somehow tied into this whole occultic movement working behind the scenes with an intense hatred of humanity and human life. But the lawyer would say, "Oh, she's so peaceful. She's not having any pain." Of course, she was on a morphine drip. That's why she didn't have any pain. Why did they have a morphine drip if she wasn't having any pain? Unless it was an intentional effort to kill her. And that's what you do in hospices. You just give people morphine until they die. But, you know, the truth of the matter was, well, I'm going to let Bill tell you what he has heard from people who were there, who actually witnessed what happened. And the pictures you saw were taken many months, if not years, before, to create an impression in your mind that dying death with dignity is such an easy thing. But that isn't really what it was all about, is it, Bill?
Well, no, and Dr. Stan, I was with David Gibbs. He was the attorney for the Schindler family. And I spoke up in Washington, D.C. at a conference on confronting judicial activism. And it was carried by C-SPAN, as a matter of fact, just a month ago, and nationwide. But there I was with David Gibbs and Chief Justice Roy Moore at the dinner table just prior to David Gibbs speaking. And Judge Roy Moore was on my left, and David Gibbs was on the right. And we were talking about the Terri Schiavo case, and I asked David, I said, "David, you know, what really went on? In the news, we didn't really hear the firsthand stories." And he said, "Well, what happened was that the husband would not let any cameras into her room. And so nobody knew how responsive that she was." And he said he was a little apprehensive the very first time. Several months before her death, the family asked him to be a counsel, to be a co-attorney. And then the other attorney dropped out, and so he became the head attorney. David Gibbs, he's got his Christian Law Association.
Hold that thought right there. Okay, pick up the story there, please.
And David said he was a little apprehensive when they first took him in to see her. He didn't know what he was going to see. He heard all the stories, Anyway, he walks in and sees her in bed with her eyes open and looking around the room, and he walks up to the side of the bed, and she turns and looks him in the eye, and there, and she says, when the dad came in, you know, she looked at him, but when the mom came in, she got excited and began to, you know, he used the words babble, you know, trying to communicate, and he said whenever the mother would leave the room, she would start crying, and he, you know, tried to explain, you know, to Terry, and he wasn't sure if she was really there and comprehending, and so he would move to the other side of the bed, and she would roll over and turn her head and look at him on the other side of the bed and look him right in the eye, and she would try to babble and communicate with him, and then he would go to the foot of the bed, and she would roll back again, and she would look at him and try to, and he said she was anything but brain dead and a vegetable, and I asked him, I said, well, where did those terms come from? He said, well, what happened was that after she had her incident, which he says they strongly suspect was domestic violence, that she was, the family and Michael were suing to get insurance money for her. And their attorney, fresh out of law school, very first case, the attorney suggested that if they used the term vegetative state, that that would cause them to get more money from the insurance companies for her rehabilitation. And so based on that legal counsel, they went ahead and did it. But the parents never thought in their wildest dreams that the son-in-law would use that term in a later date to try to kill her.
But, of course, the thing is that there are other doctors who came in who gave the testimony she was permanent vegetative state, and they simply perjured themselves because a doctor knows what that term means, and that means that somebody is just totally unresponsive. They obviously brought in people to testify and to give sworn testimony who were part of this pro-death, pro-euthanasia, pro-so-called death with dignity movement, which is really nothing more than planned murder.
Yeah, I mean, one of the doctors they brought in spent like 5 minutes with her, didn't do any MRIs or any CAT scans or anything like that, and the doctors that are in the neurosurgeon field say that you never do that. When, you know, a typical analysis of somebody's brain, he says you do these set of tests. Well, the doctors at Michael Schiavo did not do any of those tests. Anyway,
hold that thought just a minute, Bill, because we're going to bring our other stations back on, and of course we want them to hear as much of the story as we can. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course William Federer is telling us about his conversation with Mr. Gibbs, who was the attorney who had been engaged by the family several months beforehand, describes going into the room with Terry when he first met her and walked up to the side of the bed. She looked at him. He tried to explain to her certain things. He didn't know whether she was really getting with it, so he walked around to the other side of the bed. She rolled over, looked at him, went to the foot of the bed. She looked down at the foot of the bed. She responded when her father came in. She responded when her mother came in, got very excited, and of course sort of babbled on, trying to communicate. Certainly nothing permanent vegetative state. Everybody who said that was simply lying, but then the whole thing was a lie to begin to get the American people to say, well, if the judges say it's all right, we've just got to let them be killed, just like happened in Hitler's Germany, when they said, well, there's certain lives that are not worth living, and what was the first thing they did? Why, they get rid of the people who had severe disabilities, and then the people with psychiatric problems, and then the Jews, and then the gypsies, and what you never have heard of is that there were 12 million others that they killed in the concentration camps. That is covered in a book called War for Genocide by Professor Norman Cohn, a Jewish scholar who writes about the Holocaust and the 6 million Jews, but in the foreword of the book, he talks about the 12 million others. Why don't we ever talk about those? Because they were predominantly Christians. At that time, Germany was predominantly a Christian nation. But so we don't want to alarm the Christians in America. Oh, we wouldn't want to alarm them. So we just talk about the 6 million Jews, but never the 12 million others who died in the concentration camp. So pick up the story there, please, Bill.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. Well, when I was talking to David, he went on to say that there were three theories of how she originally fell ill. One was that she had a heart attack. And he said that they don't think that was really what happened because her blood tests and the way that doctors, and you know this better than I do, the way that you medically can tell if somebody had a heart attack, she did not have any of those test results. Besides, she never had any heart problems before or after. So they don't think that was it. The second theory, they said, well, it was bulimia. It was her not eating properly. And that was, and they, he said that the family knew that wasn't true because they made that story up. That was part of this lawyer's counsel to get money from the insurance companies for her rehabilitation. And, that, the suit was they sued her gynecologist for not asking enough questions to find out if she had an eating problem. And that was what the $2 million settlement was over. Now, that was a big stretch, but juries nowadays give those type of awards.
Yeah, but it was all based upon deception, and tragically the family went along with it.
Yeah, yeah. And then the third thing he said...
But that attorney should be disbarred. For an attorney to bring in something that he knows is untrue just to get a large settlement. But then I suppose when you have attorneys who don't believe in God and courts who don't believe in God and judges that don't believe in God, why not lie? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, they do that all the time now. And anyway, the third thing is it was domestic violence. That was what they suspected. And he said there were several testimonies of people who had... experienced Michael Schiavo putting them in headlocks, like a brother-in-law, and that he would wrestle around like that. Anyway, he was a very controlling husband and would keep track of her mileage when she would drive around town, and because he didn't want her to visit the parents, and you know, would count the money and make sure that she you know, didn't spend. Very controlling, and she he was the only man that she ever kissed. I mean, she was very naive coming into this relationship with him, and after about 5 years of this controlling situation, she mentioned to a friend at work about 3 months prior that she was thinking of leaving him. And then shortly thereafter was when he called the brother, and he said, oh, she fell out of bed and she's in a clump on the floor at 6 o'clock in the morning. And then he calls the father and tells him, and the father says, did you call 911? And he goes, no, I'll do that right away. It's like, wait a second, if your wife is in a clump on the floor, you called 911 first. But anyway, when the emergency technicians arrive, he was sitting on a couch and he pointed and he said, she's over there in the hallway. Now, what type of person is going to sit around with your wife struggling to breathe? But her symptoms was that her situation was that there were 5 minutes where she didn't have blood to her brain, and that was what caused the brain damage. So that was what David said was suspected when it caused the whole problem. Michael didn't have a job. He had a hard time holding down a job, and he ended up living with the parents. And so then for several years when they were doing the lawsuit to sue to get money for her rehabilitation, you know, he was right there, and they were working together. He even cried in the courtroom in front of the jury, saying that he was committed to her for life and would do everything he can for her rehabilitation, but he needed this large settlement. And so they gave him close to $2 million for her rehabilitation. And David Gibbs went on to say that as soon as he got the money, he took her out of the rehab center and put her in a hospice to die, that he had all rehabilitation stopped, that he wouldn't let any medical attention be done to her. One nurse, he said that her fingers would sort of, you know, be pulled together, and one nurse had woven a washcloth between her fingers. And when he came in one time, he said, who did this? I told that no rehabilitation shall be done. Had all the pictures taken out of the room, all music taken out, the blinds closed, all radios, all visual and audible stimuli were taken out of the room. And then he goes on to say that she didn't even need a feeding tube, that she did eat Jell-O and pudding, and that when they would brush her teeth, she would swallow the saliva and swallow the toothpaste. The only problem was that the nurses, nurses' staff didn't want to take the time to feed her, you know, because it took a lot longer. And so they suggested that, look, you know, it'll be better for her. She'll get better nourishment. Just stick the tube in, you know, and but their motivation was to save time. And but she really didn't need the feeding tube.
Once you put that in, then all you have to do is justify taking it out, and then they die. And this is a very, very clever technique that's used, and it's been used in other cases where they wanted to kill somebody. They said, oh, they have to have a feeding tube because they can't eat or drink. They put the tube in, and then you pull it out, and they could eat or drink, but you don't want them to eat or drink. You want to kill them, and that's exactly what they did here.
Yeah, I mean, he said the family was just shocked that as soon as he got the money, that he turned around and used the money to hire these pro-death attorneys. This George Filos advertises that he's a death attorney, and he's been in several cases, and he's into Scientology, and he said that he can tell if a patient wants to die by looking into their eyes.
Well, I think for our listeners, they have to realize that Scientology is certainly one of these occult beliefs. It was created by a man named L. Ron Hubbard, who was into the occult. And unfortunately, they have a whole different perspective and view of life. So, you know, if you're coming out of Scientology, you certainly are not coming from a pro-Christian or pro-humanity, human life support situation. Position.
And but on and on, I was just appalled hearing all this. And David Gibbs went on to say that the mother would come in and cradle Terry's head in her arms and would say, say I love you, and she would say I, and Terry would say ah, and say love, and she'd say love, and then he'd say you, and he said she could never get the you down, you know, but she could say the ah and the of, and but she would do it on command. I mean, it wasn't the mother would say it and she would respond. I mean, she had. I talked to people who had family members that were in a lot worse vegetative state, and they said that she was miles ahead of their children, you know, that were handicapped. But what happened was the husband wanted to divorce her, and you know, the suspecting of domestic violence could possibly be a motive of why he didn't want her to be rehabilitated to testify against him. A week before the feeding tube was pulled out, a millionaire in California offered Michael Schiavo $1 million if he would just let her live, and he turned it down. Again, why would you do that unless you simply did not want this person rehabilitated?
But wasn't the family willing to take her home and look after her and just care for her at home?
Oh, yeah, they were begging to do that. You know, the last day, a week into the starving, the family went into the room. She said it was just a real small room. He said you could almost reach across it. I mean, you could touch the bed with one hand and the window with the other hand, he was in there, and Father Frank Pavone, the last several weeks, was called in by the family, and he was on the very short list of people who were allowed to visit, Father Pavone said that, and I was with him, and he spoke at this event I was at. He said that while he was sitting at the bed, there were two police officers watching him at all times, to make sure that he didn't give her any water. And when he would bend over to, like, pray in her ear, they would move from the side of him to the bottom of the bed so they could get a clear line of sight to see if he was doing anything.
In other words, the police officers were there to make sure she died.
Yeah.
And they were simply carrying out the orders of the court. They were simply doing what they were ordered to do. That was Eichmann's defense when he was taken back to Israel. I was simply carrying out orders. It was all perfectly legal what happened in Hitler's Germany. The judges decreed it. And if you haven't seen that wonderful film, A Judgment at Nuremberg, you still get it with Spencer Tracy and Burt Lancaster. And the judge's defense was, well, we just thought we did what was best for society. I'll go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, when you see the Father Pavone said one time, he had a small handheld watch in his hand, and he was on the side of the bed next to her, and the police officer said, "What's that that you have in your hand?" And he opens it up, and it was a watch. He goes, "I'm sorry, I'm going to have to confiscate that." And he's like, "What, do you think I have water in the watch and I'm going to drip it in her mouth?" He said it was so surreal to have the police officers guarding to make sure that she died. And
I think this is really what's so significant about this. There was tremendous political pressure to want to kill this woman. Now, you can argue, well, is it worthwhile living? That is not up for me or the judge or even the husband to determine. That's really up to God. God has his rules, and when we start avoiding those or violating those rules of God, why, we lay our society open for terrible, terrible judgment, I believe.
Well, you bring up a good point, and you touched on it earlier in Germany. The Holocaust didn't just happen overnight. It started in the Weimar Republic. They adopted the idea of quality of life versus sanctity of life, that the people, based on the Hegelian utilitarian ethic, that your worth is dependent on your utility, that if you can contribute something to the whole, your life is worth something. And, of course, we teach that in our schools called situation ethics. If there's too many people on a lifeboat, the little kid has to decide which one's, useless and shove him over the side. And, of course, that's played out every week in this Survivor series, the program on TV. If you can contribute something, you get to stay on the island. If you don't, you get voted off. So we're being conditioned in this utilitarian ethic that your worth is dependent on your utility, which is totally contrary to the Founding Fathers and the Declaration of Independence, where they said that you're endowed by your creator with certain inalienable rights, that you have these rights not because you're useful to society. You have these rights because you're made in the image of God.
And, I think it's really so interesting that you point out the Survivor, how so much of our television is being used to create our beliefs, to create how we feel about things, how we address the issues. In fact, everything on television, really almost everything there, has in one way or another an importance in altering our Judeo-Christian values and replacing them with the humanistic values, which represent the real religion of America today, no longer a Christian nation, but a humanist nation. All we have to do is get those crazy Christians out there and crazy fundamentalist Jews to accept the idea that life has no real value, other than, of course, how it can benefit the state.
Well, all the programs, like the American Idol, if you don't cut the mustard, you get voted off the show. The Donald Trump thing, you're fired. It's all based on a group of people, and you whittle through, and the ones that don't meet up are rejected. They even have the horrible date program where they're, they choose and they reject. But it's different from the Judeo-Christian ethic of, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that, whatever you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done unto me. Mother Teresa reaching out and taking the disadvantaged and lifting them up, whereas these programs are all, hey, you're not good enough, you get kicked out. It is conditioning the public and that's what happened in Germany. They even had math problems in the school textbooks.
Hold that thought right there, Bill, because we're going to be bringing our stations right back now. Well, we were just talking about how, of course, so much of television, so much of what's going on today is to condition us to say, well, certain lives are worth important, certain ones are not. On the Survivor, if you don't benefit the group, why you get voted off the island. We see this recurrent theme, of making value judgments as to who will get thrown off the show, and, of course, even taking this back to Hitler's Germany, why there were certain lives that were deemed not worth living. And these same ideas, of course, are being increasingly applied here in the United States as television is used to change our attitude. And Bill was saying that even in the textbooks in Hitler's Germany, what was that all about?
Well, they would compare the cost of keeping an elderly person alive with the cost of a young couple getting a loan for a starter home. And, of course, the kids doing the math problems would say, gee, it costs so much money to keep this old person alive, and that money could help you know, a dozen people get loans to have their starter homes. And so they adopted this idea of Lebensunwertes Leben, which means life unworthy of life. And they considered it an act of mercy to free somebody from their body of pain. And that they even had films that they called Ich Klage An, was, it means I accuse in German, was this famous film that won an award at the Vienna Film Festival, where they actually, a man euthanized his wife in one room while he was playing the piano in the other, you know, and it was a real person dying on the film while they were filming it. And so they used the movies to condition the public, and what happened was Germany went to nationalized health care. That's why they call it the National Socialist Party. It was a socialist country. Even the swastika was a double S for the SS, which meant socialist, you know, the party there. And so the government took care of everybody's health care in Germany. It was great. I mean, you didn't have to pay for your health care, and everything was fine until their economy cratered, and they had a double, triple-digit inflation. And then the people cried out, government, do something about it, cut all these expenses. So the government decided to cut useless expenses from the budget, like keeping alive retarded, insane, epileptic, chronically ill. They sent them to the gas chambers. And then after that, they got rid of the elderly in government institutions that had no relatives and no financial resources. I mean, these people certainly had a low quality of life. Nobody ever visited them. They were all alone. And so they sent them to the gas chambers. And then they got rid of the parasites on the state, the convicts, the murderers, the street bums, the beggars. They called them useless eaters. And they thought, why should we have to pay taxes to support these murderers in prison or in welfare for these useless eaters who don't contribute back to society? And so they were rounded up and thrown in the gas chambers. And then after that, they got rid of the ideologically unwanted, the Dietrich Bonhoeffers, those other 12 million that you mentioned that were religious protesters. And then finally, basing it on evolution, they said the Aryan race was more evolved than the other races, and so they called them Übermenschen, supermen, Übermenschen. And so they wanted to eliminate the inferior races from the human gene pool, and they called them the Untermenschen, under mankind. And they considered gypsies and Jews and so forth as Untermenschen. And this was, of course, based on Ernst Rudin was a advisor to Hitler, and he had worked previously with Margaret Sanger, the lady who started Planned Parenthood, and she came up with the idea of eugenics, where, you know, you wanted to eliminate the weeds from the human garden and to, you know, sterilize unfit races of people. And anyway, so this whole thought went in to getting rid of an inferior race, and the Nazis considered Jews inferior, so they sent them to the gas chambers. But all that horrible Holocaust started with this idea of Lebensunwertes Leben, life unworthy of life, equality of life versus sanctity of life. And this Judge Greer, who, by the way, these liberal legal organizations are giving him an award, but this Judge Greer said that he didn't think her life was worth living.
What is that so reminiscent of the life that was not worth living? That was, of course, the justification used in Hitler's Germany. And, of course, it was Rudolf Hess speaking publicly, who said, Nazism is nothing more than applied science. Nazism is simply applied science. And once we accept that, of course, when science, of course, comes from knowledge and truth, who could be against applied science? That's what the extermination of the Jews was. Cleaning up the gene pool and the gypsies, and then of course the 12 million others, many of whom were Christians. Well, after all, you have to be a little crazy to be a Christian, don't you? So believe me, ladies and gentlemen, we're well on our way down the slippery slope. And the fact that the media shows you over and over again those films of Michael Seibel bending over his wife that had been taken months ahead of time and didn't tell you about what really happened, Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Bill Federer. Bill, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there?
Well, Father Frank Pavone said that it was anything but a beautiful death. He said it was horrible, that every day they would go in there and they would see her wasting away more and more. He said it was so ironic because there was a nightstand next to her bed and somebody had put a vase with flowers in it, and the vase had water in it. And he thought, here, if I were to take some water out of this vase and put it in her mouth, it would be a crime. And, of course, there were two policemen in the room watching his every move. And then David Gibbs said that, you know, he had visited her almost every day with the family. And after the feeding tube was taken out, a week went by, and she was starving. And he said they went in there, and the mother was just so visibly disturbed. She had, you know, cradled Terry's head in her arms, and the mother started crying, and then Terry started sobbing. And he said Terry's face was sunken in. He said it was sort of like you could see her skull, and like a black eye only went down almost the whole entire length of her cheek. He said her mouth was like totally dry, and her skin was cracked, and they were, you know, would rub lotion on the skin where it was cracked, but they wouldn't put any water in her. And but he says that here Terry losing water already, but here she was sobbing and crying. And then after a few minutes, he said that the mom said she couldn't take it anymore, and she left the room and never went back. That was the last time that she saw her. And David Gibbs said that here he was standing at the foot of the bed watching this scene of a mother cradling her daughter's head, and they're both sobbing. And he said, for the first time in my life, I was embarrassed to be an American. He said, the first time in my life, I was embarrassed to be an American witnessing this woman being killed by the court system. He says, the judge never once visited her. Now, you would think if you were going to sentence somebody to die that you would at least visit them once. He never did. And he bragged about that there were no Ten Commandments hanging outside of his courtroom door. Of course, he was making reference, you know, to Judge Roy Moore and the other ones who did have the Ten Commandments out there. It was just a travesty. And, of course, 5 minutes before she died, Michael Schiavo came in and made them all leave. And then after she died, Father Frank Pavone wanted to go in, and since she was Catholic, he wanted to pray over her. And they wouldn't let him in. And he said, you know, a scene...
Hold that thought for just a moment as I bring our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is William Federer, and he's just describing the scene here. Of course, the pictures you saw on television of this woman looking so, you know, at least she's, skin is clear, your eyes are, you know, are looking at her husband. But those were not the pictures, because they wouldn't allow any pictures. As her eyes began to sink, as her complexion grew gray, as her cheekbones began to exude, as her skin became parched, as they killed her, she could have drunk water. She was capable of drinking and swallowing water, but they wouldn't allow it because they wanted to kill her. And that was what it was really all about. And that was never brought out. All you saw was this picture over and over and over again on your television screen, creating your reality. And you must understand that your reality is created by what you thought you saw on television. And then, of course, you know, the lawyer saying, oh, she is so peaceful. She looks so good. She's not suffering at all. She's not having any pain. Death with dignity. You see, there are people who hate humanity and would have mass killing in America. And but they first have to condition the minds of the American people and bring the judicial system in line. And once the judges say it's all right, why, of course, they can kill anybody they want to.
Well, and Father Pavone said a scene that he'll remember for the rest of his life was he and David Gibbs standing in the doorway of her room, not being allowed in by Michael Schiavo and the policeman. And so there in the doorway, in the hallway, they bowed their heads and said a prayer for Terry and for the family. And but, you know, here in America, in this great country where the Statue of Liberty holds up her torch high and says, send me your poor, your you know, vulnerable, And here, the world witnessed, and I mean, the murder of an innocent woman, totally capable of she did not have a terminal disease.
She was not able to swallow water. She could have taken food and pulled. Right. But they would not feed her because it was easier to have in the tube. Then they take out the tube and they have the justification for the murder. And the fact, in fact, that one thing you commented when we were off the air, that the lawyer said as he looked at this scene, it was the first time in his life he was ever ashamed to be an American. And everybody listening to this program bears part of that shame. If you've not spoken out against this and pointing out that they know exactly what they're doing, and of course all the posturing in Washington, D.C., and in the state capitol by Jeb Bush, you know, it was all posturing. Jeb Bush had the ability to sign an executive order. The president had the ability to sign an executive order. If Janet Reno could send 125 armed SWAT team members with automatic rifles down to kidnap Elian Gonzalez so they could send him back to Cuba to build up the stature of Fidel Castro, certainly why President Bush could have sent down five police officers and said, we are taking over here, you are in violation of the 14th Amendment, you do not have the right to take away this woman's life. And he could have done it by executive order and nobody would have objected. I believe that the majority of the people would have championed him, but it was all play acting. It was smoke and mirrors. It was rhetoric over reality. We want to pander to the public and make them think that we're doing something, but we're really not going to. So much of what goes on today is simply that. It's for the psychological impact on the American people, and they don't understand they're constantly being manipulated by the invisible hand that controls the media, and specifically television. Those pictures of Michael bending over his pretty wife, there is what you think you saw, but that wasn't what was really going on, was it?
No, and it's, David said it was so obvious. For 7 years, when they were fighting to get money for her rehabilitation, I mean, I may have the number of years not remembered correctly, but for a number of years when they were suing to get money for her rehabilitation, he mentioned several times that he did not know what her wishes were as far as, you know, living will and, you know, and no sooner did he get the money than all of a sudden he remembered that when she was 21 years old, in their first year of their five-year marriage, when the first year, he says that he remembers they were watching TV and somebody was on a ventilator, and he said that he remembered her saying, oh, who would want to live like that?
But Terry wasn't on a ventilator. She could breathe. She could swallow. She could eat. She could recognize. She could respond. She wasn't on a ventilator.
You're exactly right. But this was, you know, you think, well, what evidence did this judge have to sentence her to death? The only evidence was Michael Schiavo saying that he remembered, as soon as he got, you know, as soon as he got the $2 million settlement money, he remembered that, you know, 15 years earlier, watching TV when she was just 21 years old, he said that she saw somebody and said, who would want to live like that? Now, based on that hearsay from somebody who clearly has a conflict of interest, that should not have been allowed as evidence in court to kill her.
Well, first of all, Garcia was living with another woman. He had had two children with this other woman. You know, he had he was living in adultery. There are laws in Florida on adultery. Whether you agree with them or not doesn't matter. They were on the book. He could have been arrested and put in prison and deprived of his right to determine the future of the woman he wanted to kill. He wanted to kill her. If he was dedicated to his wife, he wouldn't have fathered two children with another woman. I mean, this is just the most ridiculous thing in the world. But, you know, the thing is, the judge got away with this, and what is really so frightening is that the other judges all support him.
Yeah.
In fact, when this went to the federal court, it was the Republican judges including William Pryor, of course, who had betrayed Judge Roy Moore and then been rewarded for getting Judge Roy Moore out of his position as Chief Supreme Court Justice, who was rewarded for his the betrayal of his promise and Judge Roy Moore by being given by the Bush administration an interim appointment on the circuit court that actually voted on Terry Schiavo. And, of course, the William Pryor voted just the way President Bush wanted him to vote. He voted to kill her.
Well, another thing, I said, well, David, I said, weren't there nurses or somebody that could testify, you know, on behalf? He goes, there were five of them that had their written affidavits, sworn testimonies, and Judge Greer would not let them be admitted in court.
Now, in fact, I read one of those affidavits where the woman was talking about how, you know, she would, many times Terry would respond to her, and she would put those notes in the progress chart, the nursing notes, and somebody would remove those notes. Her statements on Terry's responses, we removed them from the notes for the next morning. So there were people there working in the hospice who wanted to remove any mention of the fact that Terry was responsive and was communicating at least as best she could with this nurse. This nurse realized it was murder, and she, in this affidavit she wrote out, saying, somebody would come in and remove my notes. How could you do that? That's a violation of the law. But all of this is violation of the law. They wanted to kill her. And when you understand that, it all makes sense.
Well, and then another nurse said that when Michael would come to visit, he would close the door and turn the thermostat way down, so I guess to give her, you know, pneumonia. And one time after he left, she went into a seizure, and they did a blood test and found out that her insulin levels were way off.
Probably she was hypoglycemic. You give insulin, it just knocks the sugar level way down. That was probably what they would have been testing.
And they found that there were needle holes and needle marks in her arm, and there was an empty vial in the trash can, where evidently Michael it indicates that he possibly injected her. But
that is a favorite way in the hospices. They are actually killing people today, is giving them an overdose of insulin. I had a nurse who was caring for a diabetic patient, and he was caring for him at home, a very caring nurse, one of my surgical techs. He told me the people from the hospice who were coming around to see him regularly said, why don't you just give him an overdose of insulin? And my nurse friend said, I couldn't do that. That would kill him. Oh, well, he'd be better off that way. And this was somebody from the hospice who was visiting. Ladies and gentlemen, there really are people in America who are evil. And until we recognize that, you can't recognize anything going on.
Wow. Well, that's what those nurses testified. But they were not allowed to give testimony in the court because of this Judge Greer. What you had mentioned, that all the other judges up and down the line stood behind him. It was such a travesty to see this. David said that last day when the mother was crying and Terry was crying and the mother left the room, as she was going out, she mentioned to David, she goes, how can they do this to my little girl? And I mean, the mother's saying, how can they do this to my little girl? How can they just decide to kill her?
How can we justify murder in America? Well, I suppose if you're not concerned about what's going on in Iraq today, why should you be concerned about killing just one person here when you think of the number that are dying in Iraq? And yet, of course, it is the same anti-human philosophy that is beginning to permeate every aspect of our society. And as it happens, then no man's life or family are really safe.
And it's a repeat of what's happened in Germany. You know, I love Mother Teresa's attitude. Her idea of death with dignity is not to pull the plug. Her idea of death with dignity is to go to Burma and India and find the person dying in the gutter and pull them out and give them a bath and a meal and treat them like a human being so that they can have dignity when they die, rather than a horrible, undignified way of starving them to death. You think we wouldn't have done that to a convicted criminal? If you had dogs or horses, you know, on your property and you didn't feed them or give them water, the animal shelter people will come and remove the animals. They will take away your right to be a guardian of that animal. If you have children in your home and you don't feed your children, they'll come, the Family Protective Services will come and take the children out of your home. You will lose your right to be a custodian over them. And so, by all accounts, Michael Schiavo should have lost his rights to be the guardian over Terry. But again, this judge was so totally committed to having her killed, and to think that the American Bar Association, the president, wrote a letter defending the judge. And I asked
Michael, think that tells us a lot about the American Bar Association, doesn't it? The morality of the leaders of our legal profession.
And I asked David, I said, you know, why...
Now, this is David. This is David Gibbs, the pro-life attorney who is representing the Shivas.
I said, with all this pressure that came on this judge, you know, why didn't he wake up and realize what was going on? And he said that he got this attitude like, you know, this is my story. I'm sticking to it. I'm digging my heels in. The more pressure you give, the more I'm going to stand by my decision. It was almost like he, you know, the idea that, you know, if you challenge their decision, they take it as a personal affront, and they want to even stick more and more to their decision out of pride.
Well, you see, you could understand why one judge would be corrupt, but are all of the judges corrupt? And in fact, you know, the federal level, my understanding is the Democrats were the ones that voted, you know, in favor of not going along with this. It was all universal, the Republicans, judges, and I'm a lifelong Republican, so I think I can speak out against this. Oh, I said, no, we will not intervene here. Just let her die.
Yeah, well, this judge had claimed to have been a Republican, and I mean... I can't believe that, but he said he was.
But if they're seeing the thing is, there are a lot of people within the Republican Party who do not value the life. This is what it's not a party issue. It is a humane issue. It has to do with whether you think there is a right, whether there are absolutes, whether God does say, thou shalt not kill. And if you don't believe that, then maybe it's expedient to go ahead and kill those who have lives that are not worth living. But where is the outcry from the American people? That's what I want to know. I mean, you know, they can get hundreds of thousands of people out marching for civil rights, but when they're killing a white woman in Florida, why, of course, nobody seems to really care.
Well,
they got maybe, what, a couple of hundred people out at a demonstration.
And the problem is that people weren't getting the real news, and so it was hard for them. I even talked to Christians, and they were like, oh, if I was in that state, I'd want them to go ahead and send me on. It's like, wait a second, she wasn't in any state. She wasn't, you know, on a ventilator or any life support. And, you know, who are we to decide if somebody else's life isn't worth living? Make that decision, then no life is protected.
Right. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, if you please. Do you have any additional insight to what I had only heard as a single Sunday morning early news blurb on the radio, that this same Judge Greer, and for all I know, self-assigned, was to have exclusive purview over, this is just a week or two after her death, over what medical, court, whatever other records were to be released to the public?
Do you know anything at all about that?
Yeah, right. And that's exactly right. And also, the medical examiner is in that county, is under that same jurisdiction, that same judge. And so we couldn't expect to get any type of revealing autopsy of, you know, because there was strongly suspected that she had suffered some domestic violence. And, you know, but then... her body was ordered to be cremated by Michael Shivo after this, this coroner's report that he was just, you know, friends with the judge. So it's sort of like a small little corrupt county was able to get away with this. And
I think that probably what you heard is right, Roger. And thank you so very much for really calling. I think that's a very important point, and I haven't heard this emphasized, but I think it should be brought out. Thanks so much. Let's go to Dan, who's calling us from Washington. Hi, Dan. What part of Washington are you in?
Eastern Washington.
Go ahead. You have a question for our guest.
I know you've always advocated sort of the rule of law as the way that the country should be, and I understood that in Florida, or at least in that county, that the rule of law states that the spouse is the one who makes the decision on sort of life and death, like those sort of situations, and the So it was really in the purview of the law what happened.
You mean it's perfectly all right for a husband who has no longer really a husband because he's having an adulterous affair, and of course, according to the law, he could have been arrested and put in prison and deprived of his spousal rights. You see, that is the law of Florida. Why shouldn't that law be enforced?
Well, and plus, they did pass a law saying that you can't withhold food and water.
Right. Anyway, thanks so much. Dan, you want to hang on?
That's okay. You answered my question. Thank you.
Dr. Thank you.
Dan.
Bye-bye. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment. This is a very controversial issue. People say, as long as the judge says it's all right, we should go by the law. That's basically what our last caller was saying. The law says that the husband has the right to kill his wife, so it's all right to do it. It's the law. How do you feel? We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Barbara calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, or I guess from SoCal. Barbara, did you have a question for our guest?
Actually, a couple comments and a question. I had heard that the money that Michael had been awarded for Terry's care actually was running down and that there was not that much left.
Do you know anything at all about that, Bill?
He got $1.8 million, and that the moment he got it, he took her out of all rehab. And then he began to spend the money on attorneys to have her killed. And he ran through the money using it for attorneys.
And I understand that somehow or other that the state was picking up part of the expense there at the hospice. Do you know what you can tell
about
that?
Right. Yeah, the state was paying most of the hospice expenses anyway.
Right.
And but, you know, you had brought up a point before that the rule of law, that there's laws that were passed in Florida that said that under no circumstances can you withhold food and water from somebody. Well, a liberal judge decided to invalidate that law. And so then it comes down to, what is the law? Is the law what the people decide through their elected representatives and through passing a law? I mean, it seems to me anybody that studies government, you have the House, the Senate, and the President. They're the ones that make the laws. And all the judges are supposed to do is to make sure that the laws are carried out in accordance with the intentions of the people that wrote the laws.
But, you know, originally, of course, law was to be based upon God's law, and it wasn't really what the president wanted or what the legislator wanted, but originally our law was based upon God's law. How far we've gotten away from that. Barbara, did you have another question?
Just one other thing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Michael's attorney had addressed the Hemlock Society.
Yes.
Also, you know, and I believe Michael also was quite in favor of the euthanasia movement.
So what about that, Bill? Do you know?
Comment on that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The attorney George Fellows was outspoken in advocating death, and he was involved in several other cases where, you know, they took away the rights of people and had them killed. One of the things, I was doing a radio show in Florida at the time, and a caller called in and said, you know, years from now, there's going to be written a book called The Perfect Murder, where you, you know, if you strangle your wife and bring her to the point of death, but she doesn't die, she's brain damaged, then you sue to get millions of dollars, and then once you get the millions of dollars, you just withhold the life support and have her die, and you know, I mean, it's the perfect murder. This attorney...
Hold that thought there for just a moment here. Okay, fine. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is William Federer. Bill, go ahead.
But you know, back to the caller's you know, point there, it's one of those confusing situations, but when you get down to it, she was not given her rights as a human being, and we've had this terrible tragedy.
And that's a terrible, terrible tragedy. But you see, it reflects on every American, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And the church one day will stand, you know, before the bar of judgment for the failure of the American church to take a stand in times like this. Anything else you'd like to say, Barbara?
No, thank you. Just thank you so much for bringing out all these facts.
God bless you. Thank you so much for calling. And, well, our guest has been William Federer. I'm going to have to let you go, Bill. Thank you so very much for being with us. And of course, would you like to get your website out there? We do carry many of your books, but if people would like to get to your website, how can they reach you?
Oh, thanks, Dan. It's AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com. I send out a free daily email called an American Minute, things that happened each day in American history. And then 888-USA-WORD is the toll-free number, 888-USA-WORD. And I just recently did a new book called Backfired, A Nation Born for Religious Tolerance No Longer Tolerates Religion.
Did you send us some of those you were going to?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Well, we will be carrying Backfired, and you want to get it. We'll get Bill back to give you the background of this. This is an amazing book. The Origins of Tolerance in America came from the Christian Church. Oh, my secretary just said they're in stock right now, so we have them. Thank you so much for being with us, and I look forward to getting it back again.
God bless you.
And you too. Bye-bye.